All right, so here we go. Last lecture, you made it, 15 weeks, yay! Lecture 30, December 6th, keep calm, it's the last one, carry on. I don't know if anybody went or paid attention to this pitch competition last week for our students. They pitched their ideas in the idea competition, and these folks all were first place winners and came up with, I think, $500 towards their project. And as first place winners in the spring, they can pitch their idea for big bucks. So yay to our students who participated in that. Good job. Course evaluations, we're still not doing that good. We're at 35% so far. You're adding out of a possible 0.5%, which is something. We're at 0.19%. I don't know how to encourage you anymore to do what you should be doing anyhow, which is do the course evaluation. Yeah. A whole 90 seconds? Oh, well, that's probably the problem then. I see your point. Yeah. All right. Well, I also like it, though, if you had a few comments in, like these things we're talking about. But I understand, yeah, it's 90 seconds of work to help everybody and you add extra credit. Do what you want to do by December 10th. So, yay, last class. As we know, next week is finals. We'll get around to that. So tomorrow, the review only, not graded. Mini-test 14 will open, and it'll cover the material that was not on a graded mini-test. That's lectures 27, 28, 29, and 30. Why would you want that? To help you see what you know and what you don't know for the final exam. Use it, don't use it. It's entirely up to you. We've seen this before. Right now, if you, on average, added 3.1% to your final course grade, that is not chopped liver in a grade. I mean, that's coming up on half a grade. Plus whatever credit we get for completing the course evaluation, I won't know that till the end of the course. Final exam date, Monday, December 11th at 8 a.m. through Thursday, December 14th, closing at 6 p.m., covering lectures 21 to 30 and the associated textbook material. I, of course, will post that explicitly so you know what it is. Final exam, we know what it is. We know how it works. Anyone have any questions on the final exam? Nobody's giving me any questions until I get 400 questions on the day of the final exam, but okay. Yo, yo.
The thing that was sent out on all the grades, they were saying what we needed to get each grade to test, was that personalized per student?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, because I saw me and Emma had a lot of the same percentage down.
Well, maybe you guys cheated entirely on the two exams and had exactly the same scores, and therefore you had the same end results. Besides which, what are you looking at his stuff for? This is FERPA. You can't be looking at his stuff.
We just confirmed.
I'm just messing with you. So no, it to the extent that you have the same current grade, right, so 82.5-ish, then all those grade columns, what you have to do on the final to earn A, B, B minus, C plus C, they're going to be the same, right? If you have an 82 and he has a 94 and those grade columns look the same, there's something wrong there. But presuming your current grade is about the same, unless there's an error, but so if you have a question, something doesn't look right, let me know. But yeah, if the two current grades are about the same, then indeed the what you need to earn on the final to earn A minus B would be the same. Yep. All right, any other questions? Final exam. So, in years past, in the old days, Super Bowl was such a big thing, we were always talking at this time of the year about Super Bowl and their ads and what was happening. I guess it's become such an old hat in the industry, I'm not seeing a lot of stuff about Super Bowl, but I thought it was still at last fun to see something about them. Super Bowl 2024 ads and the brands buying them. As NFL teams battle to make the NFL playoffs, brands are finalizing their Super Bowl battle plans for the February 11th grade in Las Vegas, so their ad strategy. CBS in early November reported that ad inventory was virtually sold out. Commercials are going for about $7 million for a 30-second spot. Got to sell a lot of shaving cream, similar to the 2023 game. Ad Age's definition of a Super Bowl commercial includes all national spots between the coin toss and the end of play. So how's your ad budget? Can you afford a $7 million 30-second ad? Oreo, I put them, they chose them out of the list because we've heard from Oreo recently, plans to air a 30-second ad during the second quarter. It's the Mondelez-owned cookie brand's first Super Bowl ad since what we talked about last time, 2013, when its real-time Dunk in the Dark tweet drew wide praise, overshadowing its in-game ad, which we heard about last lecture. Hellman's plans to run a 32nd spot in the second quarter. Spot will continue to highlight Hellman's multi-year Make Taste Not Waste initiative. The campaign aims to raise awareness about food waste during an event that's one of the biggest food waste occasions of the year in the U.S., and Hellman's role as an ingredient for repurposing those leftovers and not wasting your food. For the last 3 years, we're proud to say that our message got people talking about leftovers. We even saw an increase in the conversation about food waste by double digits, and we have plans to make this year even more impactful. So the ad message and, of course, conversations on social media. The ad will appear on CBS as well as Univision for the Spanish language broadcast, so reaching the target audience. Bud Light will be at the Super Bowl, still dealing with their little problem. It's starring Peyton Manning and Emmitt Smith as the brand touts Super Bowl ticket giveaway. Bud Light has enlisted Peyton Manning and Emmitt Smith to kick off what the brand is calling its biggest Super Bowl ticket giveaway ever. So celebrities in advertising and something we've talked about, sales promotion. In a new ad released on YouTube on December 1st, Manning buys a round of Bud Light cans for a crowded bar and distributes them using his quarterback's arm, turning bar patrons into wide receivers, including one who encounters Emmitt Smith's impromptu referee act. So this is a version of their ad.
What do you have?
Two Bud Lights. Actually, make it a round for the bar.
Round for the bar!
Bud Light, easy to drink, easy to enjoy, and for sports fans everywhere. So the push comes as Bud Light continues to look for a way out of the severe sales slump brought on by the Dylan Mulvaney controversy that began last spring. Parent AB InBev has been relying on football, particularly Bud Light's status as the official beer of the NFL, to help turn the tide. The new ad continues the easy to drink, easy to enjoy brand platform established during this year's Super Bowl. So we're seeing brand image repair and the ad message. As part of the campaign, Bud Light is giving away Super Bowl tickets and NFL playoff tickets. Fans can enter by scanning QR codes on Bud Light purchases or by posting Bud Light logo and hashtags on social media sites X, formerly Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Getting consumer involvement in social media is what they're trying to do. Additional prizes include tickets to the Bud Light Backyard Tour presents Zach Bryan concert in Las Vegas on Super Weekend, gift cards to Uber Eats and Instacart to help fans stock up for the at-home Super Bowl parties, and they're giving Super Bowl tickets to 25 winners who receive two tickets each. So sales promotion, get people involved in the brand buying the product. With Super Bowl tickets in extremely high demand, we're proud to be the sponsor bringing the most fans to the stands with Bud Light's biggest Super Bowl ticket giveaway ever, rehabbing the band, being involved in the big event of the year. Lecture notes, page 288, chapter 21, page 614 in the textbook, and hopefully onto chapter 17, wrapping up implementing interactive and multi-channel marketing. We'll see how this goes. So we ended up last time, we were listening to Valerie Twing talk about doing prospecting, how she, as a consultancy firm, can get people's attention, even though they're very busy, by providing them with value, showing how they can fulfill those potential clients' needs, excuse me, and getting to meet with them. Excuse me. Me. Presentation. Handling objections. Unfortunately, your customers and clients, prospects, won't immediately buy your product from you. They have objections. So salespeople have to seek out those prospects' objections in order to address and overcome them. When a prospect offers an objection, I don't know if I'm ready, it often signals that they need to, and want to hear more in order to make a fully informed decision. If as a salesperson you don't uncover the objection, then you can't manage them and you don't know why you're not making the sale. So uncovering objections, asking clarifying questions, and overcoming those objections is a critical part of training for any professional salesperson. It's a skill area that has to be continually honed and developed because there's always going to be objections. So how do we handle objections? Well, one approach is to acknowledge the issue and convert them. You're absolutely right. We are more expensive than the competition. You're right on that. But the reason we're more expensive is we guarantee our specifications, we guarantee our delivery time, and we can have it there 2 days earlier than anybody else. So we are more expensive. But those are features you said you wanted. Convert. Postpone. So it doesn't seem like it's going to fit in your budget now, but we have a new budget period coming up at the beginning of the year. So let's come back to this and see if it fits in next year's budget. Agree and neutralize, a bit like acknowledge and convert. Acceptance, nope, you're absolutely right. We cannot produce these in purple. It's just not something that we can do, but we can get them in green. So purple is not something we can do, you're right. Denial, especially if it's not true. Who said that we can't go to Europe with you? That's not correct. Ignore. I don't know how that's going to cost you to win the sale, but I suppose that's another approach as well. Then, when we're ready, when we've moved along, when we've answered the objections, it's time to close the sale. What we're trying to do is get a purchase commitment from this prospect, create them, make them into a customer. So closing is asking for the order and adequately addressing any final objections or obstacles that that potential customer might have. Lots of approaches to closing and ways to do trial closing as well. Okay, so now that I've addressed your concerns, what other questions do you have that might impact your buying decision? If there are none, then we can move along to the sale. If there is one, then we can answer it. I don't especially like the assumptive close when used on me, but closing doesn't always mean literally asking for the order. Using the assumptive close, you can ask the prospect, for example, so how many do you want and when would you like them delivered? I didn't actually ask you for the sale per se, but I assume we're getting the sale. So how many do you want? When would you want them delivered? Urgency close, only use it if it's true. Don't lie, don't steal, don't cheat in the classroom, in your personal life, and business. So don't lie if it's not true. But I tell you what, this is only open until the end of December. January 1, we go back to the regular prices, the regular delivery schedule, the regular specs. So if you're interested, and I think you should be based on what we talked about, let's get this done before the end of December. Final close, this is it, we're done. Either take it or leave it, we're getting out of here. Now, sales professionals can either be too weak in the close and never really get the person to commit one way or the other, or too aggressive and turn them off. If you're closing the sale, be sure to ask for the order. And if the prospect gives an answer other than yes, well then, it might be a good opportunity to find out why. Find out that new objection and continue selling the potential customer. Follow up. One reason we do this with people and not computers is because the professional can follow up, ensure the customer is satisfied with the product or service. Was it received in the proper condition? Did it get there on time? Was it installed properly? Did the people get proper training? Or maybe you have to do that training. Was the entire process acceptable to the consumer? If there are any problems or issues, you, the salesperson, become their advocate to the company to get these things resolved. And of course, that builds a relationship and it makes future sales possible. It's a critical step in creating customer satisfaction and building long-term relationships with customers. Just what I said, if they have any problems, you, the sales professional, can intervene and become an advocate to assure 100% satisfaction. And while you're working with these people, you might find some new needs, additional purchase opportunities. If you're really doing a good job, get referrals and testimonials that you can then use with others as sales tools. So what sorts of traits do successful salespeople have? In general, there's always exceptions. They care about the customer's interests. We are trying to bring value to your organization. Truly. Hopefully you're working for a good company that does that. So I'm interested in what I can do to relieve your pain point, to solve your problem, to make your life easier. I care about you. Now, I care about me too, but I care about you. They're confident. They believe in their product and themselves. They're always on. You know, so the Steelers or Browns lost yesterday. You can't be down today in your sales call about it. They're not pushy. They're resilient. You have to have some resilience. You know in sales you're going to get turned down. Spring back. You know people are going to have objections. Spring back. They're extroverted. They have to be willing to, you know, talk to people. They're good listeners. How are you going to hear what the issues and questions and problems and concerns are if you don't listen? And they're skilled at multitasking. They can think about a variety of things at once. This is a cutesy little approach. Somebody went out and interviewed some top salespeople in different areas. He calls them the sales gods. What can we learn from the sales gods? First of all, they make the people they're talking to feel important. This writer says, well, it wasn't always easy to get time in their calendar. Once I was actually speaking with them, they made me feel as if I were the most important person in the world. And that's quite a trick when you consider that I'm not even a customer. You listen to people, your intent, your present. They're all unbelievably upbeat. Talk about positive. In all five cases, the experience of having a conversation with them left me feeling with an aura of good feeling that lasted for the rest of the day. I'm not kidding. It was almost a drug-like high. That's upbeat. That's confident. They obviously love their customers. They don't just like them. They love them. They think of them as friends and family. They cared whether or not their customers are happy. They cared about their customers' lives. They cared about how their product or service fit into their customers' life goals. Really. If you really care about people and you really have a good product, you really should have a good relationship and you should have some pretty good sales. They all have fabulous product knowledge. They know what they're selling up and down and sideways. They know everything there is to know about their products, and they aren't afraid to point out what their products don't do. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. Don't lie, don't cheat. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. In your life and in your business, don't exaggerate, don't lie. They know they're changing the world. Even Bruce Benkenhoff, who sold gigantic yachts, expressed a strong conviction that he was making the world a better place. All of these sales gods felt they were in the business of making people happy. More than technique, more than skills, more than business acumen, more than brand, and more than anything else, it's your professionalism and how you see the world that determines whether you'll reach the pinnacle of sales success. If you're lucky enough to work for a good company and have good training and actually help people solve problems, that's not a bad life. This is our friend from AAA Mobile Homes. We haven't heard from him in a while. Let's see what he has to say about this topic.
Selling, personal selling is very important when you're selling a house. It's the largest financial decision a person is going to make in their entire life, and they want to feel like they've gotten personalized service, that you weren't busy at the time, you weren't answering the phone, that you gave them 100% of your time. The point is that personalized sales and service is key. You have to give the people, you have to live in the now, and you have to make them feel like right at that moment that they're the most important thing to you of anything that's going on. You could have problems at home, you could have relationship problems, but you need to give that person 110% when you're in front of them, make them feel important, and explain to them, you know, what it is that you can do for them, find out what they need. Don't put them in a house that doesn't make any sense for them. If they need, if they have four kids, you know, you need to find out what they need and why, you know, what it is about their personal living experience right now that they want to change. Because that'll give you a clue as to what they need, and then you can help guide them in. I like to say we use a consultative sales approach. All we're doing is helping people. We're not really selling. We listen to their needs, and we try to fulfill their needs. If you can do that, the sale just happens automatically. You don't really have to work at it. there's no closing to this process. You just figure out what they need, help them into it. You show them the right thing. It's magic. They just, they're thrilled to get it. So it is very important to have the personalized sales in a product this large. It's the single most important buying decision they're going to make in their lifetime, and they want to feel like they made a right choice.
The only thing I don't agree with them is there's no close. Well, here we define close as asking for the sale, so obviously there has to be some close. But other than that, I'm with him 100%, and he's with me 100%. Listen to people. Understand what they need. Deliver to them value in terms of what they need to solve their problem, and you got a sale. What are the 10 biggest mistakes in sales? First, not selling the solution. Focus on how your product and the company can solve the three most critical problems your client is trying to solve. You got their attention. Being too dependent on the sales presentation, especially young, new salespeople, they develop that sales presentation, and by golly, they're going to get through it all, whether or not you're ready to buy already, whether or not you're tired, whether or not you're in a different direction. Being present is more important than the presentation itself. Not asking the hard questions. Ask these questions. How do you feel about our price? How do you feel about our terms? When would you do business? Why would you do business with me when you've done business with our competitor for so long? If you don't get the answers to these hard questions, you'll find yourself not closing the deals and not knowing why you're not closing the deals. Believing price will solve your client's problems. Your buyer may seem obsessed with price, may demand your lowest price, may claim the budget cannot be violated. Despite this, every one of them will pay a higher price for a superior solution to their most pressing problems. So do not be going with the idea price is going to solve your sales problems. Presenting without the intention to close. You have to present with confidence, not arrogance. You have to set the stage early that you know your product can solve their problems, and you fully expect to make a sale with them because you know the value you bring to the table. Not asking for the close early enough. You want to break your presentation into stages, and at the end of each stage say, well, have you heard enough to make a decision? It's a form of trial close. If no, then you move on to the next part of the presentation. Waiting until the end of the presentation to share the price. Have you ever gone to buy something somewhere where the price isn't obvious, you don't know what the price is going to be, and you keep wondering during the entire interaction, how much is this going to cost me? How much is this going to cost me? They're not really paying attention to you because they're interested in how much it's going to cost, right? So his idea is initiate price. Don't wait until you have to answer how much. Otherwise, no matter how intrigued they might be by your presentation, they're wondering the entire time, what's it going to cost? So he says bring it up early. Ignoring influencers. You remember the buying roles and the roles in the buying center we talked about? Gatekeepers, influencers, users, buyers, deciders. Ask, who else other than you will influence your decision, or who else would you like to have involved in this decision-making process? Using a free trial to close a deal. This guy says, grow up and close the deal or go get another customer, because giving stuff away for free will break your company. Not practicing urgency. Too many sales organizations never insist on closing a deal for fear of appearing to be a nuisance. Wait a minute. I'm here to try to help you solve your problems and fix your pain points, and I don't want to ask you if I can do that? Doesn't make any sense. If you truly believe in your company, your product and service, you have to learn how to insist on closing the transaction now. He says, I've made the mistake too many times of not practicing enough urgency, and then having some time pass and events occur beyond my control steal the sale away. Your sales team should train and drill on how to press without being unprofessional or appearing to pressure, but asking for the deal, asking for the close.
Hello, I'm Ellen Daniels, and I'm the sales program coordinator here at Kent State University. And I'd like to invite you to consider getting the professional sales certificate. What that tells employers is that you've done extra work. It's a professional certificate. It augments any degree you have, whether it's in business or not, and it allows you to learn some valuable communication skills. What it entails is taking one of our introductory sales classes. Then you would take the advanced sales seminar, which is another way to increase your communication skill knowledge. And then the last part is to complete a sales internship. And there's more information with your advisor. But I'd invite you to listen to several of my former students and how the sales certificate has been able to help them move forward in their careers.
We won't do that right now, but lots of folks have found the sales certificate to be quite helpful as they've graduated and moved on. So relevant courses, Marketing 45046 Professional Selling, Marketing 45047 Advanced Professional Selling, or the sales certificate itself. Think about that if any of this appeals to you. All right, we made it through the last element of the promotion, and now we come up on chapter 17, implementing interactive and multi-channel marketing, which for me brings together stuff we've been talking about. So, chapter 17. So here we are, we've seen this framework. Remember, we started a long time ago at the 40,000 foot level, 30,000 foot level, 10,000 foot level above what you guys do in your first job. We've been talking about the four P's of the marketing mix: product, pricing, place, and promotion. And now what we're gonna do is bring some elements of promotion and distribution together to talk about this topic of multi-channel and omni-channel marketing. So, in chapter 15, your textbook uses the terms multi-channel marketing and omni-channel marketing to mean the same thing. Here, we're gonna use the term omni-channel marketing rather than multi-channel marketing because it's sort of what's hip now, what's trending, the terminology used in the field today. This is because the traditional view of multi-channel marketing is that it is a strategy to reach consumers via different channels of distribution, which may or may not be well coordinated with one another. Omni-channel marketing is a multi-channel sales approach that provides the customer with an integrated customer experience. The customer can be shopping online from a desktop or a mobile device or by telephone or in a bricks and mortar store, and the experience for that customer will be seamless. It's an experience that they can truly get the feel of your brand. So let's think about today's customer. She, for example, starts her internet search on a laptop. If she needs the item right now, maybe she uses voice search on her phone to find the closest location. When she gets to the physical store, maybe she uses a well-timed relevant coupon that she gets exclusively on her phone on the sales app for mobile devices. Or if she doesn't need a product right away, she may shop online and personalize her purchase and have it delivered or picked up in a store and keep it or return it by mail or in store. True omni-channel strategy is what makes this seamless experience possible across all channels, personalized to her specific needs and desires, and requires a little bit of planning on your part as a marketer. I'm going to use, for the rest of our time together, Sephora as an example of omni-channel retailing. How many of you guys know Sephora as a brand? Most of us? Yeah? So Sephora, a leader of prestige omni-retail. The company's goal is to create a shopping experience that enables beauty and cosmetic customers to purchase products confidently. They've mastered the art of bringing both the offline and online customer journey into a holistic shopping experience, omnichannel marketing. Between 2017 and 19, Sephora consistently reached revenues of $6 billion, a near 50% increase from just 5 years prior, when the personal care giant was only registering about $4 billion. The company phased out its contract with JCPenney and opened shops in Kohl's stores with a target of 850 locations this year. The plan includes an omnichannel partnership with the launch of Sephora on Kohl's.com in conjunction with the store opening. So what are we seeing them doing here? They're having growth through multiple channels of distribution to reach new customers, but still maintain the customer experience. Sephora's omnichannel retail strategy can be honed down into several key strategies that they use to accomplish this goal. First of all, they develop an authentic customer experience. The Sephora business strategy centers around the customer shopping experience. They have in-store setups, including a digital playground for beauty enthusiasts, experiential sports attractions. What fun shopping for cosmetics, who knew? Store assistants can use iPads to showcase the multitude of shades and colors so customers can try before they buy. Utilizing various mobile technology screens and customer-focused sales tactics, Sephora takes advantage of a new generation digital technologies such as augmented reality. Well, I'm not going to get the app things, but can I move that out of the way? Maybe. All right. So virtual artist, try hundreds of makeups and products on with the Sephora mobile app and use it on your phone, and you can try it all on the app or... interactive. It makes use of a lot of technology to make that all occurring. You can share pictures on the fly or videos if you like. Holy mackerel, that's fun. Second of all, exceptional omnichannel strategy. Central to the Sephora marketing strategy is the mobile app that provides customers with a certain hub, with central hub, where they can access all things related to beauty, cosmetics, and skincare. So we're having interactive marketing going on. With a bevy of new products, video tutorials, celebrity news, and fashion trends directly within the mobile app that consistently encourages customers to return, providing interesting content for people that care. Sephora's digital marketing strategy keeps its audience informed, up to date, and hungry for more to keep coming back. Moreover, Sephora has nailed loyalty marketing as well by nurturing customers who spend 15 times more than the average customer. Sephora has built a seamless, unified, and personalized customer experience by launching groundbreaking technologies like Color IQ, Smell-O-Vision, and famous Sephora Visual Artist AR app. So personalization, which you just saw, I was going to show you the picture of me with the coral lipstick. I thought it was really nice, but I forgot to bring it in. Omnichannel company culture. The secret sauce behind Sephora's omnichannel success is simple but difficult to copy. In 2018, they merged their digital and physical retail teams and developed a world-class omnichannel approach. Got rid of the silos. By creating one team, Sephora focused on overall sales rather than, say, prioritizing its e-commerce strategy. This purely omnichannel approach enabled marketers to track the entire customer journey from the online browsing to in-store interactions with sales reps and over-the-counter sales, an integrated marketing strategy by managing it at the top level to make sense. Turning data into growth. Sephora recognized a large percentage of shoppers use personal smartphones to search for online reviews, recommendations, and compare the price of products with their competitors. Rather than treating personal devices as a threat, Sephora developed a retail strategy to take advantage of mobile technologies. With the help of our good friends at Google Analytics, their analytics team was able to identify which online advertising was driving in-store purchases. The Sephora omnichannel marketing strategy was born from this data, and sales from digital ads soared by 3 times. So we're monitoring and measuring our multi-channel performance using Google Analytics to make it happen.
Today's customer is increasingly omnichannel. We wake up, we get on our mobile phone, we look on social media, we see a lipstick color that we love, we go on Sephora.com.sg and we see if it's available, and then maybe later that day we stop by the store to test out the color. This is really the journey of a consumer. We call it omnichannel, but really this is just how people are acting. If we want to fully understand the complex decision-making path of our customers, we need to better understand not just what they do on our website or buy in our store, but also the journey beforehand. Singapore is really where we have the highest penetration of retail outlets in the region, so we wanted to take advantage of that and really see if we could use that opportunity to make this connection.
The key bridging that gap was our customer loyalty program. With the Google Account team support on the integration and data analysis, we've unlocked the incredible potential of Google Analytics 360. We decided to start sending our offline purchases to our Google Analytics account to connect these purchases to existing journeys. This illuminated what online pathways finally led to sale, whether online or offline.
This system integration was a huge success for us. We turned it into an ongoing CRM integration for all of our systems across Southeast Asia and Australia. We learned that 70% of customers who research before buying visited our website on the same day of purchase. In Singapore alone, we uncovered that our return on AdWords spend was 4 times higher when offline sales were included in the after purchase.
And it's data that lets you see, geez, things happen if we include offline sales in our online stuff. You follow the data and find that that's something that's important to your customers. Data-driven mobile strategy. Given that most online searches take place on a mobile phone, Sephora saw the advantage of incorporating a mobile app to enhance their retail strategy. The app is designed to provide its customers with valuable information such as reviews and emulate a sales associate to provide relevant product recommendations. Being data-driven, which we just saw, Sephora foresaw the rise of mobile during the early 2010s and heavily invested in mobile technologies. For example, Sephora was among the first brands launched in Apple's Passbook in 2012, getting more than 87,000 app downloads a week. What was the result? Was that the result of luck? No. They knew that approximately 70% of its mobile users came from Apple devices, which is why it was quick to invest in the Apple Digital Wallet. Data drives decision making. Augmented retail strategy is part of the success as well. Beauty and cosmetic shoppers consume video content across multiple devices. Sephora takes advantage of this by including tutorials and evocative images in the retail strategy by using brand ambassadors and micro influencers on social networks and YouTube, which of course we've talked about. The importance of social. Sephora's customer engagement strategy provides customers with access to valuable content. Groups and conversations enable Sephora to build a vibrant community of beauty aficionados who like to talk to one another, ask questions, answer questions, share information. So you can start a conversation if you want. Here's the insider, here's your, complete your profile. And then we can have a series of conversations, ask questions, chat with brands, keep up with breaking beauty news if that's your thing. What's new here? What are the trending groups? Here's some information on holiday stuff, which is of course pertinent right now. Here's the makeup challenge of the week. Here's a bunch of eye color shades. Here's some people posing questions and getting feedback. You're part of a community because they care about you, you care about them. The amount of earned media social Sephora from user-generated content every month has no match in the cosmetic industry. People care, they come in, they do reviews, they make comments, they answer questions. In-store digital components such as welcome screens, menus, and sales assistants armed with mobile devices help customers to find the right product. A solid business continuity and crisis management strategy is part of their success. When stores were forced to close during the global pandemic, Sephora's e-commerce strategy shifted to expand its online offering to make it easier for its customers to search for products from the comfort of their homes. To enhance operational efficiency, Sephora tweaked its supply chain across warehouse locations, inventory management, and automation, all working together. They also took steps to align inventory with projected sales, minimizing what many of us found during the pandemic, out-of-stock products. These business moves highlighted bold business continuity skills that helped them to survive in the pandemic. So why do consumers shop and buy online? One answer is we give them choice. Sometimes the simplest approach is the most effective. When you have an overwhelming choice of products like Sephora, the minimalist web design is a good way to go. It's easy to navigate. We have engaging visuals. We have a great user experience. We have nice smart bars at the top and easy to access social media. So if you have a kajillion things to look at, maybe big, bold, simple approaches to the products and the displays is the way to go. Don't have lines and lines and lines of text. Have nice, easy to click on icons. Customization. Select the product category, the brand, and the price. Ask an online beauty advisor for help. I don't think I'm going to do that. But you can customize your choices. So choose foundation, or tinted moisturizer, or concealer, or setting spray and powder, or highlighter, and move through the list this way. Choose it by finish, shimmer for me, etc. And so you can continue through this and get down to your choice, and then ask a beauty advisor if you need help. Customization. Communication. Sephora will allow you to sign up for email. They'll give you the opportunity to have buying requests, service requests through their help menus. They have consumer-to-consumer communities. However you want your information, they're going to be able to help you out. Control. Online shopping empowers consumers to seek information, make evaluations, make purchase decisions through their provided product videos, through their click to explore this product, through lots and lots of product information when you get down to that particular thing you want, by offering customer reviews from their community members, by having a variety of ways to ship the product out to you. You get to control all of this. So interactive and omnichannel are here now. As the digital landscape continues to evolve and customers' needs and wants and desires, more convenient, more personalization, both legacy companies and e-commerce businesses face challenges to improve and adapt their business strategies. Omnichannel is not the future. It's here now. It's present right now. Retailers have to recognize it, prioritize it, make it part of their business strategy, and growth and positive results will follow. So that is my summary of Chapter 17, Omnichannel Marketing, a Real Thing, and a pretty specific example of how it can work. So after 15 weeks of listening to me gabble on, let's do a recap. We're talking about marketing. We got the four P's of marketing at the center of the consumer, and the CREST factors, those factors outside the organization that impact our consumers and so our business decision-making processes, right? C, competition. R, regulation, legal, and political. E, economic. S, social and T, technology. Those are the factors we have to track on and have talked out throughout the course, how they impact our consumers, how they impact marketing and business. Yes, CREST factors impacting our consumers and our four P's of our marketing mix. The goal, discovering satisfaction of consumers' wants and desires at a profit or to attain organizational goals through the four P's of marketing, product, price, place, promotion. With strategic brand segmentation, targeting, and positioning, STP, which we certainly talked about as a way to do business today. And here's our strategic framework for marketing management with those elements. Evaluate market segments, select a target market, select positioning, drive your objectives, product, price, place, and promotion. So we're almost to the end. So thanks for the opportunity to work on Principles of Marketing with you for this time period. That's a young guy there. Good luck on the final. Please study for it. and best wishes into your future and into your careers. That's all, folks. Have a good rest of your week, and have fun on the final. Thank you.